Dear listeners, welcome to the second part of a conversation between Paul Hughes and Andreas Hansson. And our main topic is actually repertoire or building concert programs. Paul, I've heard you say many times that you compare making a menu or comparing food and music. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, if you looked at my waistline, you'd understand why I like this parallel. But I find there to be many parallels about, which I use as a metaphor really when I'm talking to young conductors about how to put programs together. And to talk about the building up of knowledge of repertoire and orchestrations and timings, to be like creating your larder, your store cupboard of ingredients, and which needs to be going bigger and bigger and bigger and constantly adding new things to it. And that building a program has to be like a culinary journey. You don't want to give your audience food poisoning. You don't want them to be bored with it. You don't want them to ask, well, you know, what is this? I might not like it. So you would present a program and a program plan and a preparation for an audience towards a new program in the same way that you would with food. You say, I've made this dish. It's got a secret ingredient. Tell me if you know what it is. Or I think you'll like it. I know you like something that I did before. See if you'll like this. And then when the students bring me programs that they put together for various assignments, and I might say, what would this look like if it was a meal? Because to me, it looks like we've got at least three desserts in this meal. We've got two main courses, but there's, you know, how would you define this? And it's really trying to get a sense of balance in creating food, balance in creating dishes, in creating menus, and balance in creating programs. And most musicians like food. Many conductors I know love cooking, and many of them are very adept at it. But to just sort of make that parallel, it's just another metaphor for how you get people to think about balance and knowledge and how things like, you know, diversity and being asked to extend your range of repertoire and artists is no different to just suddenly discovering that there's a whole other store cupboard that you didn't know about. It's got all these exotic ingredients, all these things I've never heard of. I wonder what they're like.
Is it important then to have a kind of line in the program, salt followed by sweet or whatever? Do you think in that way as well, or can we start with a sweet?
Absolutely. I mean, not everything should or could be balanced without it being bland. You want to have the ability to know your ingredients, know your techniques, to be able to surprise and to delight, but especially to surprise, to start a program with Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. You know, there's a structure, a historical structure, the overture, the concerto, the symphony. I'll throw that on its head. You know, put the pieces in a different order. Think about them in a different way. A new piece of music on the program. Where are you going to put it? Don't just put it at the beginning and get it out of the way, but really think about the journey that you might take the audience on and surprise them in a different way. And that's just come from how I look at sort of, you know, making food and...
Do you take special care if we are supposed to then make a program, how to start and how to end? I remember a story that Andrew Davies, we talked about Andrew Davies earlier before we went into the studio. He told me that when he started in Toronto Symphony, I think, he got a call from William Steinberg, who said, young man, never, never end a concert with Brahms 3. Because for those of you who know or doesn't know, it ends very soft. Is it important how we start a program and how we end it?
It's important to think about it, but you don't have to always end, you know, big and loud and fast. Absolutely not. Take the two Elgar symphonies, for example. The first symphony starts slow and ends loud and fast, and the second symphony starts with a big flourish and ends with the most exquisite, heart-rendingly beautiful quiet coda. And for me, that is as emotionally satisfying. as anything. And it depends entirely on the journey that you want the audience to go on. And sometimes when I'm working with young conductors about programming, I ask them to draw what it would look like in terms of the emotional journey that you want the audience to go on. So where does it start? What do you want them to think about in the interval? What do you want them to talk about? How does it end? And you're in control of that as a programmer. And that's what I find so satisfying, that you can take the audience on many different types of journeys depending on where you place the pieces in your program.
All right. A provocative question then. Do we know much about the inner emotional journey of the listener?
We can guess that. We can predict it reasonably accurately from our experience of having spent a lifetime of sitting in concerts. But everybody takes it differently. It's often not the individual piece, as the juxtaposition of pieces, which is going to provide the ultimate emotional response of an audience. And you want an audience to feel something, to be engaged in it, whatever it is. And how you do that. For example, often you'll see on a program that a new piece of music is at the beginning. And unless it's written for that purpose, I don't think it's the best place to put a new piece of music, because the audience is just arriving. They're trying to remember, did they lock the car? You know, I wish I'd gone to the loo. I forgot to order a drink for the interval. There's all this stuff going around. So their ears are not fully attuned to being able to receive a new piece of music. So I would almost always try, wherever possible, to put a new piece on somewhere else in the program, which is when you then can play around with the order of the pieces and surprise an audience that used to having, you know, the overture, the concerto, and then the symphony. So it's in your gift, your control as a programmer and as a conductor, to play around with that, to surprise people. I remember doing a series of Nielsen symphonies with Sakari Oromo, and the first concert began with Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. It opened with that. And the concert, then there was an interval, then we did Mozart, Fourth Piano, Violin Concerto, and Nielsen won. The point is that the Nielsen was written in the same year as Tchaikovsky's Six, which most people would never think about. So that sort of journey, if you like, that musical journey had a logic to it. But opening a concert with Tchaikovsky's Six, one newspaper critic said that, you know, this is a highly unusual idea. And, you know, all one wants to do after a performance of Tchaikovsky's Six, if it's been successful, is have a drink and a lie down. And I just wrote him a letter and I said, well, that's what the interval was for you to have a drink and a sit down if you wanted to. But it's a perfect piece to open a concert with, if you've got the chops to be able to open with that. It opens perfectly, you know, and ends in a way that people in the interval, you're giving them something weighty to think about. And you're launching that journey of then the remaining five concerts, each with the Nielsen symphonies.
If you're a conductor in Norway and you... we're closing up to the Norwegian championships in wind band or in brass band.
Yeah, so I gather.
And you get this, for instance, the brass bands always have a piece that all the bands in the elite division play, and it's a given piece, and it's usually a new piece. For instance, this year it was Symphony of Colors by Simon Dobson, who was the... But then you need... This is a question. This is an assignment for you now, without being prepared. If I want to do a pre-championship concert and I say Simon Dobson to you, what would you combine his music with if you want to create contrast or a good menu?
Well, I'd need to listen to it first. I've never heard a note of Simon Dobson's music. So first of all, I would listen to as much as was available and then look and see what would complement it, which is highly unlikely to be more of the same. It's probably going to be something completely different.
Yeah. And how different? And where is there a borderline for different? I know this sounds like a childish question, but
No, it isn't. It's a really interesting, defined different. It's different sound worlds that are going to stimulate different responses in an audience that you hope. different. For example, it's like programming a symphony orchestra concert where you might put a small ensemble piece in the middle. You don't have to have this fat orchestra in every single piece. You can have it sort of like an hourglass shape where you're really then, and you're doing that because you want to sharpen the orchestra's ears by drawing them, the audience's ears, by drawing them in to a smaller sound world that then you can go back out again to the large orchestra. And I love being able to do that. And you can do that whether you're conducting a brass band program. And you might want to show off some of your really top players, the really top players that could play I recently went to a recital by the principal trumpet and principal trombone of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, just a duo concert. It was fantastic. Who knew? You could spend a whole evening listening to a trumpet and a trombone. I think I've ducked the question slightly.
No,
but I don't know his music, Simon's music, so I would just listen to.
Simon is a British. He's based in Cornwall and has written a lot of very fine pieces for brass band, okay, and wind band, and also for community bands or volunteer bands.
I guess the first thing I do in listening to the piece would be where to put it on the program. Mm. That's the most important thing. Where on the program, and then the rest of it is the leading up to it and the leading away from it.
Is this muscle of yours now activated?
I can't help it, really.
No,
you know, you're sort of programming about something you've never heard. A bit like, you know, commissioning a new piece and having to put the program together. I'm already thinking, okay, when I get back to the hotel, I'm going to get on Spotify or YouTube and see if I can find any of this man's music. And then think, oh, I wish I'd said that.
Yeah.
But that's how it is. You think about what does it sound like? Where would I put it on the program? And then the rest of the program will follow.
Recycling is an interesting thing in music. Do you recycle your programs anytime? If you have this, what you and the audience and the orchestra, all of you, thought this was a great program. Do you ever do the same program again with a few years interval or anything?
I don't think I ever have.
No.
That's weird, isn't it? I don't think I ever have done that, even between different orchestras that I've run. Because you might feel differently about it. Mm. So you want to put, you might, well, you will certainly take a piece that really excited you off a program that you put together, and or you'll remember and think, God, I remember we did that program. It was really, really good. But you're always wanting to move forward.
Do you ever get tired of your own on your own programming? Can it happen to you that you see patterns that sort of comes back?
Yeah, I think that's a danger that one needs to be mindful of, you know, not becoming predictable, not becoming the same thing all the time. It's partly why I started programming these less, familiar collaborations with non-musical genres, if you like. It's, as I said earlier on, it's to stop you from being bored, stop you from being stale, and finding ways of reaching different and new audiences with something that I feel passionate about, which is the orchestral experience. And for many people, if you were to say, do you listen to classical music? If they say yes, they probably mean they listen to orchestral music, but it could be gaming music, it could be cinema, movie soundtrack more likely, or whatever. But that's fine. It's still orchestral music. And so reaching that audience with a fantastic orchestral experience into which you might include something that they would never expect is part of the great, great joy of being at the service of the audience, if you like.
Do you think the gaming music is taking us backwards historically when it comes to the audience?
In what sense?
Well, for instance, I did a thing with the Stockholm Philharmonic, and it was by music by a Japanese composer that I, as an old boomer, as you say in Sweden, middle-aged white man, I didn't know anything about that, but the Stockholm Philharmonic asked me to conduct this concerto, and they sold out a full house in 2 hours. So we had an audience easily.
Yeah.
But the thing that happened in the concert was whenever a leitmotif, a leading motif occurred, it came up in the music, I could hear 2,000 people saying, oh, it was like being transferred to Bayreuth with Wagner themes, that all of the audience knew exactly what it meant. I've never experienced
it. Isn't that the most extraordinary thing, that the audience knows more about it than you do?
Yes.
So interesting.
It's very interesting, but also how the audience were really into the music and expressed their feelings whenever a theme came that haven't yet entered the scene, to say.
I love that.
Do you think this music, which is very symphonic, by the way, in many. Do you think it's here to stay with the orchestra, within the repertoire?
Well, for as long as it is, and as long as there are orchestras that see the value of doing it and don't misunderstand the value of doing it. The value of doing it is not to reach that audience and try and convert them into coming to your Bruckner cycle. It's addressing that community and providing them with what they want. Mm. Which happens to be a major symphonic score, a gaming score. And for as long as games continue to be programmed in that kind of way and that the soundtracks are valid, why not do that on a regular basis? Because these young people are coming to it and they're getting used to seeing what a symphony orchestra, not only what it sounds like, but the physicality of what it looks like. Mm.
So is it the same when an orchestra plays Suite from Star Wars, we can't presume that it opens the door to Gustav Holst?
No, but if you present those two on the programme and you signpost it in the right way.
Mm. And what is the right way? I'm sorry, I'm pushing this slightly, but I think it's interesting.
I mean, for example, the in September 2018, it was the centenary of the first performance of The Planets on the day, and I devised this program with the scientist Brian Cox, who's a TV personality and very, very popular. And the premise of doing this piece, which was, heavily trailed on social media and in the marketing information, was talking about each of the seven planets in the context of what we know now about them, as opposed to what was known in 1918 when Holst was writing the piece. Mm. And using visual images from the Hubble telescope, which were breathtaking, and presenting them on the giant screen, behind the orchestra. I mean, the place was packed, with so full that we had to open up the general rehearsal to all the kids that couldn't make it, and Brian Cox was wonderful with them. But it was such an informative thing that our core audience absolutely loved it and were led towards it with an intelligent program of feeding them information about what this was going to be like and why it was going to be so different. And also it was on TV. You can see it on YouTube now. It was a very, very good show that had fabulous images, an enormous orchestra, as you know, for The Planets. And nobody could listen to Mars live and not be moved in some way or another.
Mm.
But also the images of Uranus at the end, this tiny, tiny dot, which is the Earth so far away. It just made everybody think about the fragility of life and our place in the universe, if you like. And so it hit any number of expected and unexpected targets in that programming. And it was just, we led the audience towards it by being honest about what the presentation was and presenting them something well thought through and presented by somebody that they were familiar with.
Mm. As a program director, how do you listen? How do you hear the audience opinion about things? When I had my very brief career as a program director with the Malmö Symphony Orchestra, I got this advice from one of the former directors of the house. He said, always talk to the box office, because that's where people say what they really thought about things. Do you have any techniques just to hear what the audience is saying?
Oh yeah, I listen all the time.
Yeah. How do you do this? Because I find it interesting.
Earwig. People who are sitting behind you, you'll be ostensibly reading your program, but actually your ears are straining like mad to catch what they're talking about behind. Or I might ask people as I'm getting up. I was always sat in the same seat. I'd get up and I'd just ask them, what did you... Not, they didn't know who I was. And I would just say, oh, that was fantastic. What did you think? And they, you know, they would say, or they would tell you or whatever. And it's just... But also you can feel it. That's what I find so interesting. When you're so used to sitting in concerts, or if I've sat in a theatre piece or whatever, you can sense when the audience is not engaged. There's a shuffling. There's a sort of lack of collective chemistry in the room. And then those moments where it's electric and it's flying and everybody is in the moment, then you can tell that as well. And that's thrilling.
Does it always have to do with the repertoire when it's flying? Or when it starts, or can it be a combination?
It's a whole combination of things. The audience, the orchestra's on top form. They've enjoyed the process. They're enjoying the conductor. They're confident. Mm. They know that it's going to be a good performance. And they always, however well the rehearsals have gone, it's always lifted in the performance. Mm. And you can see that and you can sense it. And then it communicates itself out across the footlights, if you like, into the audience. And, you know, trying to when you're talking to orchestras about programming, that's... because it's such a visual medium going to a concert, what the audience sees is crucially important to their assessment of their experience. And, you know, orchestras are still slow to think, well, you know, why do I have to turn out and bow? Why do I have to do this? You know, I've just played a concert, that should be enough. It isn't. This is show business. You know, and that relationship between the conductor, the composer, the orchestra and the audience has to be constantly in a fluid relationship, if you like.
I mean, is there room for improvement here for all of us? Or
Always, I think. Improvement, just greater awareness, I think. Mm. Greater awareness, which comes just from communication and letting everybody, including an orchestra, know that they're all part of a big proposition, which is a concert. It's not just we put the concert on, we're the management, you know, you're the orchestra, you play it, and that's, you do that bit, we do this bit. We're all in it together. It's a whole organic operation. And also, you know, an orchestra can tell when the audience is on. They're really getting it. You know, and when they go wild at the end of a concert, there's nothing like it. I just love it.
Is the symphony orchestra a necessary thing in a modern society?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know and experience anything like it. Live music, whether you're listening to rock and pop, jazz, opera, symphonic music, it's the live experience which is extraordinary, and that particular art form. And people tend to forget the visual aspect of a live symphonic orchestra. And I'm not talking about people listening on the wireless at home, you know, if they've, you know, or listening online or on CDs or whatever medium they choose to listen to. I'm talking really about, and that is all generated from a live experience, whether it's in a studio or whether it's in a concert hall. The physicality of watching an orchestra play, I don't think we make enough of that from an audience point of view. You know, there are things when you're watching a symphony orchestra, there are all kinds of body language things which the orchestra does, which the audience doesn't understand what they're doing. You know, and it could be why the trumpet player, you know, as a trumpet player, just before there's a big solo, you'll just start to breathe into the instrument, warm it up a little bit. The French horn players, they're always turning the thing round, you know, and emptying this revolting spit onto the floor. Nobody tells the audience what they're doing or why the percussionists are racing up and backwards and forwards across the back. Why the timpanist has got his ear on the skin and is kind of flicking it. What's he doing? So I think there's a job of work we can do in understanding what's happening in an orchestra.
Is there anything we can do just to tear that wall down?
Yeah.
Is there anything we should think about? Is it?
Well, as a highly experienced conductor, you will, I'm sure, know. Yeah, we'll talk about clothing in a minute. But I think talking to an audience, breaking down that fourth wall barrier, if you like, in some way or another, so that it doesn't become a habit. People don't sit down and think, oh, here we go. You know, we're going to get this lecture first or whatever. But simply acknowledging that the audience is there. And this is a communication thing as well. When an orchestra is coming on stage and the audience is sitting there, some acknowledgement that they are out there, which might be simply looking out and seeing the audience is there. So that recognition that we're here and you're there, and that the conductor might want to talk a little bit about the program. They might want to talk about the new piece that are about to premiere and why it's going to be interesting and why they feel passionate about it, and a few signposts for the audience to help their way through it. The simple act of actually saying something and acknowledging the orchestra, the audience is there, for me, that immediately changes the relationship to being we're all in this together, rather than it's a transactional one. You know, you listen, we play, and, you know, don't cross that line. Mm. It does cross that line. And I think that's, if it's not abused too much, I think it can be a very beneficial thing.
Yeah, and it needs to be honest, right? No acting.
Completely honest.
No acting, but it needs to be...
It needs to be genuine. It needs to be passionate. Mm. It needs to be rehearsed. Don't just think, oh, yeah, I'm good at talking, you know, and just get up there on your hind legs and, you know, and it all goes wrong or whatever. So it needs to be rehearsed. What an orchestra looks like, clothing. That's a thorny one.
Yeah, does it matter or not?
Well, can I tell a story?
Of course.
When I first joined the BBC Symphony Orchestra, I decided, in consultation with the orchestra committee, that a contemporary 20th century orchestra that played a lot of new music, a lot of contemporary music, playing in tails didn't really reflect the vibe, if you like. Mm-hmm. So we had a long consultation about what the orchestra would wear. And the women in the orchestra, their dress was absolutely fine. There wasn't a problem. But the gentlemen, they decided in the end that they would wear black suits with black shirts and black ties. Fine. And they said, but you'll have to pay for us each to buy a new suit because, you know, and I thought, okay, fine. So I went to the business manager at the time and she said, well, you're not going to be able to get it done for the start of the new season because it'll have to wait till the next financial year, which was the end of the season. So I was a bit miffed by this because I thought, oh, you know, we've gone through all this process and, you know, we're hot to trot and ready to go. Anyway, at the same time, we had a conductor working with us who, it came out in the press, was having an affair with a very distinguished soloist, and that the language, let's put it, in some of the emails that had been leaked out into the press was fruity, to say the least. And this conductor was doing a prom with the orchestra with this soloist, and decided to brazen it out and said, you know, I've seen all this stuff in the press and, you know, we're just going to be professional and carry on, you know, as business as usual. Anyway, it got nearer to the time of the concert and he decided that discretion was the better part of valor and withdrew from the concert. And the conductor that we got to replace him was so much cheaper that the money we saved enabled us to buy the suits for the start of the season. And that's how we redress the orchestra. And I've never got involved in their dress since because it's such a minefield of disaster.
We are near to the end of this very interesting talk with you, Paul Hughes. But I do need to ask a few short questions, like favorite food?
Oh. Favorite food? Gosh, that's difficult.
Yeah, the next one is even more difficult. So,
well, I'm in Norway at the moment, and I had a Greek food last night. So, I mean, it very much depends on company. You know what I like. I eat a lot of fish. I love fish and seafood, and I like Japanese food, and I like food. That's a tough one.
Favorite composer. I know it is a difficult one.
I'm asked this on a really regular basis by sort of either, you know, family or punters or audience members you bump into. And it depends. My favorite composer today, it's usually how I answer. Well, today, you know, I've just been thinking about this, or I've just been programming that, and I've just been working on these chamber music programs and looking at the music of two women composers whose music I really love, Anna Klein and Caroline Shaw. And then I was listening to a piece by Magnus Lindberg the other day, and I just love his music as well. So For a programmer, you can't, it's like, you know, which of your kids do you like best? Which is your favorite? Can't really, you don't have to answer that. and it has to be one of your own. Mm. It depends.
Yeah, but that's a very fine answer, isn't it? Because that's how we should be as artists, I think.
Yeah.
Finding our ways in programming as well, because if you're stuck with Brahms, for instance, you're stuck with Brahms, but changing is a way of an artistic process, I think.
Well, I think the way to not be stuck with Brahms is what you put Brahms with and recontextualize it. And then it's not stuck with, but the joy of having Brahms there.
Last question. Which team would you support when it comes to skiing, Norway or Sweden?
The winning team. Always support the winning team.
That's very clever. My deepest of thanks to you, Paul Hughes, for visiting us here.
It's a huge pleasure, Andreas. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
So did I.
And, anytime. It's been great to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
Du hørte på Dirigentloftet. I studio i dag var Andreas Hansson og Paul Hughes. Tekniker Sverker Rundqvist. På saksofon Petter Vettre.